From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell on reopening the economy, weird flights to D.C., and what's generating the most phone calls to her office these days.
The state has processed 1.2 million unemployment checks in the last few weeks. But if you're one of the people that hasn't gotten them, it's scary, it hurts, you're scared, and you want to get through the system.
Also, as Michigan businesses consider their reopening, one restaurateur walks us through the retooling of his flagship brand. And a barber in Ypsilanti tells us what he misses most about his shop.
It's difficult. It's very difficult because it's times like this where you realize that you were doing a lot more than just giving haircuts. You know, I mean, we get some people that don't even get a haircut. They just come to the barbershop just for the conversation.
And Michael Jordan, Isaiah Thomas, and the beefs that never die. That and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we'll catch up with a few more of Michigan's small businesses, including a barbershop in Ypsilanti that provides so much more than just a haircut.
I have clients that we talk sports. I have clients that they want to make a career move, and we talk about it. There's literally nothing that I haven't talked about, witnessed, or experienced in the barbershop, and every day is different.
But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has announced a date for reopening Michigan's factories. This is huge news for the thousands of auto workers and others who can be brought back online. As we've heard this week, that won't be a simple process. The state is still ramping up virus testing and contact tracing to try to get better information about the spread of COVID-19, and there are numerous other issues to be worked out for those who are still idle. Debbie Dingell represents Michigan's 12th congressional district, including towns like Dearborn, Lincoln Park, and Ann Arbor. Congresswoman Dingell, welcome back to Stateside.
It is great to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about what you're hearing from folks in the 12th district based on conversations you've been able to have with them in the past couple of weeks.
You know, I talk to a lot of people. I'm on the phone from 6:30 in the morning, frequently to 10 or 11 o'clock at night. One night this week, it was past midnight. And people are still worried about their unemployment checks, although the number of calls is beginning to diminish.
We should say there are people who have not been able to file yet, even though they've been idle all this time.
So it's a very scary thing. I think that one of the things I try to tell people, and it doesn't really matter if you're the person that can't file or can't get through, but none of this existed 6 or 7 weeks ago. The state has processed 1.2 million unemployment checks in the last few weeks. But if you're one of the people that hasn't gotten them, it's scary, it hurts, you're scared, and you want to get through the system. You've got small businesses. I have some good conversations now. At the beginning, nobody could get through. They were scared, they were panicked, they're worried. They're still scared and worried, trying to figure out what reopening looks like. Some still can't get through. But some of my small businesses have gotten checks. So that's a good feeling. And I'm spending a lot of time on the phone with the UAW, the workers, the car companies, the vehicle manufacturers, the suppliers, the dealers, because the auto industry is still the backbone of the American economy.
I want to talk more about the resumption of some manufacturing in Michigan. But before we get to that, the whole subject of reopening sectors of Michigan's economy has become increasingly polarized in recent weeks. There are people in the city of Detroit who are still very concerned about their health and the health of their families. Meanwhile, people in less densely populated areas of Michigan feel like they're having to bear the brunt of the economic fallout, even though they may not know many people who are sick. What is your take right now about whether it is safe and appropriate for some Michiganders to get back to work right now?
You know, I think that there's a real problem in that we need to listen to the scientists and the doctors, and that they need to drive the decision making. But it being safe for us to go back to work, it's being safe to even go out, means that we've all got to participate in following what is recommended, which means we need to wear masks. It means we need to physically distance. There are some places that are safer than others, but there are people that resent being asked to physically distance or to wear a mask or to take other steps that protect the public good. And I think we're at a real crisis in this country, and we need to have the conversation about how do you protect individual liberties, but how do you protect the common good? And you may not wear a mask, but do you have the right to give me a virus that could kill me? And that's part of the intense discussion happening in this state right now.
You've spent some time talking with your colleagues in Congress about a bill to assist the auto industry right now. Considering the blowback that came down over small business loans that went to some of America's larger corporations, is that a wise move at this time?
So let me be really clear. There is no bill. So we have a letter that's saying the auto industry matters. But when you're talking about the auto industry, you're talking about an ecosystem. And unlike 2008, where there was just plain blunt mismanagement, this is a situation that wasn't created by anybody. The OEMs themselves are not at this moment asking for help. They need to keep liquidity. But the workers, the suppliers, there are many suppliers that employ under 500 workers, or the largest being many of them, and most of them are under 15,000 workers. They're worried about their jobs. They're worried about, are they going to have something to go back to? The first thing that I'm worried about, and I know almost everybody in the ecosystem is worried about, is how do you reopen safely? How do you keep the worker safe? How do you change the assembly line? How do you ensure that there are guidelines and protocols in place that keep the workers safe? Then you've got to educate the workers about them, and then everybody's got to practice them. So if somebody goes into the plant and decides they don't want to wear a mask, okay, what's that doing to everybody else? We've got to get through that and making sure that suppliers, people forget that when we're talking the supplier community, we're talking smaller businesses from 100 under to larger businesses. And oh, by the way, when we're talking about small businesses and restaurants, a lot of them are supported as the supplier community and the autos reopen. So there's this interconnectedness of all of us. So suppliers need liquidity. There are suppliers that do not have the money to be able to afford the raw materials to make the parts that the autos need. So the autos are working with banks to try to give them that liquidity, but it's not clear what's going to happen. There may be some need. Down the road, if our economy has come to a total standstill, and there's a need to just incentivize demand so people have jobs and can start spending money, that may be necessary. But everybody talked about the airline industry. Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm a car girl. I'm from Michigan. There are a lot of jobs dependent on this industry in this state. Nobody's asking for a handout, but it's an industry that still matters in this country, and people should not forget it because it accounts for almost 5% of the private sector jobs in this economy.
You're part of a bipartisan coalition called the Problem Solvers Caucus that held a virtual congressional floor debate this week to talk about what another stimulus bill might look like. What kinds of issues came up?
You know, there are lots of people with lots of different ideas. And I think that what's important right now is that everybody listen to each other. I am someone that thinks that human life matters, and that we got to make sure that the number one issue is to keep people safe. And how do you do that? Now the PPE issue is no longer just a matter of hospitals and nurses and doctors and people in those rooms, but as companies reopen, making sure that they've got access to masks and other material that they need. Then how do you make sure that we still continue to pay for every COVID test? That if somebody is sick, that they don't come to work because they're afraid that they can't afford to stay home for 2 weeks? How do you make sure that we're giving support to small businesses? And how do you do it? Do you do it with paycheck protection programs? Do you do it with, there are a variety of ideas. We're listening to the different economists. We need to give state and local governments support. They've been devastated. They are the people that are at the very local level managing public health.
Do you think there's going to be consensus for some aid to cities and counties in Congress?
I think that every single member of Congress has small cities and in their districts, and that every one of those small cities and towns needs help. And I would be very surprised that there will not be a majority of people supporting it.
You know, speaking of testing for COVID-19, there have been disagreements among House members, a little more prominently among Senate members, about rapid tests for the virus. The thinking is that representatives go to Washington, D.C. to take votes and do meetings. It's a hot spot, and also come home to the districts. You guys are some of the few who are regularly traveling right now. Can you tell us what your trips to Washington, D.C. are like these days? I mean, can you avoid touching doorknobs or doing other things that might contribute to spread of the virus?
I think it's very important that we be treated like every other American. We need more testing, period. But we should not be getting access to tests that other people aren't. Traveling is a very eerie experience. The morning that I traveled back to Washington to vote last, I was the only person going through security. And I did not see another person till I got to Gate 54 at Detroit Metropolitan Airport, where Rashida Tlaib was already there. We wore masks. I had actually somehow gotten a hole in my glove, so I had to change my gloves, but I wiped. I had Purell, which, by the way, I've had for some time because I stocked up on it when John was sick.
Oh, gosh.
Nor do I have access to gloves or anything else that I didn't have because I already had it because of John. But there are not a lot of people. There were 7 people on my flight to Washington. There were 15 on the way back, and 12 of them were members of Congress. If I open a door handle or I touch something, I immediately wash my hands with Purell.
Are the number of people that you see on, say, the House floor, are those numbers still pretty small?
The way when we are on the floor, it's managed by the House doctor and the Sergeant of Arms. And we go in one door and out the other door. We keep physical distance. I think what's unfortunate is the wearing of masks is more partisan than it should be. The top scientists, who I don't think are Republican or Democrat, but they just want to keep us alive, have recommended we need to wear masks. I think all of us should be following those guidelines.
Congresswoman Dingell, thank you so much for your time, and we wish you safe journeys.
Thank you. Everybody, be safe and healthy.
You've heard of drive-through testing sites for the new coronavirus. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about how one of them up north is working. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As more tests for COVID-19 become available, drive-through testing sites are popping up all over the state. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston went to one in northern Michigan to see how it worked.
If you want to test for COVID-19 at the Bel Air Family Health Center, get in line. Because of their scarcity, tests are saved for healthcare workers with symptoms like coughing or shortness of breath. Next on the list are people in assisted living facilities and prisons.
Then we go down to any healthcare workers that are not symptomatic. And then the fourth category would be people working in essential functions.
That's Dr. Lawrence Young, the chief medical officer of the health center. If you meet the criteria, you can get a COVID test in their drive-through. Dr. Young is going through the site now to show how it works. A nurse approaches his car. She's wearing a protective gown and a mask that looks like a see-through welding helmet. She pulls out a 3 to 4 inch long cotton swab that looks like a long Q-tip.
So the swab is going to go into the back of your nose. It's going to make your eyes water, might make you sneeze. It's going to be could be a little uncomfortable. I'm going to get your temperature first.
After taking his temperature and blood oxygen level, Dr. Young lowers his face mask just below his nose so it only covers his mouth.
Just cover your face with the mask, so in case you cough. There you go. And we're going to go put your head back just a little bit.
She puts most of the swab into Dr. Young's nostril to reach the back of his throat. He's clearly uncomfortable. His eyes well up and he winces through it. After a few seconds, the nurse removes the swab and places it into a sealed container.
It sounds really bad, but I mean, I think to me it's worse to get your blood drawn.
The nurse then tells patients to isolate themselves until results come back. The clinic even offers documents to explain that to employers. The samples are sent off to LabCorp. Young says because they don't rely on the state's testing, they may get results a bit quicker.
We're now at the point where we can safely say 3 to 4 days is the vast majority of results, and some of them are as soon as 1 or 2 days.
If the test comes back positive, the health department starts contact tracing to figure out who else may have it. Under recently passed federal law, COVID tests are covered by insurance. If you don't have that, Dr. Young says the test can run from $60 to $100 depending on where you get it. There are only a handful of drive-through testing sites in northern Michigan, but there could be more soon. Dr. Young says they have about 100 tests on hand right now, and they get a new shipment once per week.
A few weeks ago, even, it was very hard to get our hands on even more than a day or two of testing material.
Young says another bottleneck is his staff's personal protective equipment, which is in short supply these days. Now he says the real danger is uncertainty. As it heats up, Young says more people will travel to isolated rural communities up north.
We're all equipped for vast numbers of very ill patients to swamp our clinics and our hospitals. I don't know if we're 2 weeks behind. I don't know if we're going to see any significant surge. I fully expect we'll see something.
He says forms of quicker testing, like machines that spit out results in as little as 15 minutes, aren't FDA approved yet. But more tests are becoming available. Within the next week, the health center wants to start using self-tests, where the patient has a full kit and they administer it themselves. That will also better protect the health center's staff. Dr. Young says for the time being, the best way to fight the virus is to stay home.
By staying home and staying safe, you protect others. You just, you know, have to figure out some inventive ways of keeping yourself, you know, engaged and healthy, too.
In Traverse City, I'm Max Johnston.
Even as the economy begins to reopen sector by sector, the next few months will not be business as usual for bars and restaurants. Social distancing guidelines will significantly cut down the number of customers who can be seated for dine-in service. For the farm-to-table restaurant Grove in Grand Rapids, that just wasn't feasible. So the owners have completely reinvented the place, turning it into a pop-up carry-out operation. Decisions are being made every day by Essence Restaurant Group. One of the owners, James Berg, joins us now to talk about the pivots that his businesses are making right now. James Berg, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Let's go back to when the restrictions first came into play. Governor Whitmer ordered restaurants and bars to close their dine-in services on March 16th. What were those first couple of weeks like for your team?
Well, it was one of the most difficult times for our industry as a whole. So as we told the team, this wasn't just happening to us, it was happening to all of us. So immediately we took the approach that, you know, we weren't going to kick dust and dirt and feel sorry for ourselves. We were selected as an essential service that we still could do carry out, and we would have to figure out how we would go forward. But just, you know, all of a sudden you had to tell 100 people that they were furloughing them and they couldn't work tomorrow. I mean, that was one of the most difficult things I had to do as a business owner.
Yeah. I've got to believe that a restaurant like Grove was in some ways living the dream for someone like yourself who's been in service industry. I mean, it had to be painful to see that happening to something that really did bring something different and a lot of people loved.
Yeah, I mean, Grove was our kind of jewel, the crown jewel, just in the sense that we were able to open it because of the success of Bistro and Greenwell, that it was our playground. It was our chefs where we created meals for, ideas for other restaurants at times. Our executive chef, Jeremy Packman, transition from the head chef to our executive chef of the whole company, and our original partner chef, that's where it's his playground for the company. And just from a service perspective, a beverage, it was our place to play in the industry where you don't get to do that very often. If we were just open Grove as my only restaurant, I wouldn't be talking today because it wouldn't have lasted 9 years. So it was very sad and very emotional to let that go. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a business, and a business needs to make sense from a plus and minus standpoint.
When did you decide to totally transform what Grove had been?
After about a month of doing what we call putting food in a box at Greenwell and learning
takeout service. Yeah.
Yeah. Doing the carry, what we call the carry out, and creating a zero touch policy and really working with the community, working with the hospitals, delivering foods to the frontline workers, and, you know, working with our Kent, delivering lunches to our health department, Kent County Health Department, you know, and obviously to our customers. So we were looking across the street at Grove, because Grove is right across the street from Greenwell. We're like, man, Grove is just not going to work in this new world. The new normal, as we're calling it. It's just a small, intimate restaurant, and it's not going to survive on seating 20 people on a Friday night. So we said we needed to do it, create another carryout restaurant. And a Friday night, after putting a lot of food in a box, and we, Chef Jeremy, Head Chef Mike, Hillary, my partner, and Tristan, our general manager at Bistro, we all kind of came up with a concept. Chef Mike had the idea in the back of his head about chickens. And that night, within a half hour, 45 minutes, we came up with the whole concept, literally on a napkin, if you will, the name, and sent it to the marketing company and had the cheeky logo within a couple of days, and we're off and running.
So the new incarnation of Grove, Jimmy Burger's Chicken Shack, is centered around roasted chickens, the kind of thing that people might pick up at the grocery store now, but that certainly can be elevated with a little care and love. Why did that seem like something that people would want right now?
Well, we say it's gourmet roasted chicken. It's not just the whole chicken. We just opened last weekend to our first full menu. You know, it's a place that it starts with the whole chicken, and it just goes down through the whole menu. From, we'll eventually be doing chicken wings, and we'll have like a chicken pulled sandwich, and we'll have a little more one-off offerings for people, because eventually we want to transition into kind of a fast casual where you can just come in, you order your food, you sit down and eat it, and we'll still have beverage service, and we'll keep the carry out and the catering as well. But it's all about gourmet roasted chicken. I don't see the whole chicken being it'll be a part of it, but not the whole part of it. And because you can get a roasted chicken at Meijer, Costco for a fraction of the price, but the quality that we're serving is way better. But at the end of the day, what's the appetite for somebody to pay for that?
Well, if I can just put on my home cook's hat for a minute, the genius of this, from where I'm coming from, somebody who has to get dinner on the table for a family 7 nights a week, you know, roasted chicken is such a staple of so many people's diets, and yet it's not, like, it's something that everybody will eat, and it's something that can be done in much more interesting ways if you have a mind to.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what we're going to do, and it's a you know, the jerk chicken sauce is just out of this world. It's just, I ordered one a couple nights ago. I like it the next day because I like it the cold. I just eat everything cold. I like it that way. The coleslaw, the Dr. Pepper beans.
Now you're singing my song.
I look forward to it all day. That I had my leftover chicken in the fridge, and I knew when I got home later in the night that I didn't have to, you know, it was all there. And it just, yeah. So I agree. Yeah. I mean, but it's just elevated, and it's a local farm, Miller's down in Indiana, Michigan border, a great farm. So it's a great chicken. When you have the mindset that we have at Grove and take that to chicken, what we're going to do it the best that we can do.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Berg of Essence Restaurant Group. It's perhaps best known for its high-end offerings at Grove in Grand Rapids, but he also operates the Green Well and the newly opened Jimmy Burger's Chicken Shack, which is the latest incarnation of what used to be known as Grove, in the new social distancing restaurant market. How is the demand for takeout foods right now based on what the restaurant group has seen overall?
Well, we had to close Bistro, so we lost all of our sales at Bistro. We just transitioned to Greenwell to do to-go right away because the menu lent to that, and it's in a neighborhood. So right now, Greenwell, for the last month, we've been doing basically little more sales than we were doing at this time last year. So it's transitioned well into the carryout arena because the demand's high because you can't go out to eat. And it looks like until Michigan, May 28th. So we're going to be doing this for a minimum another 3 weeks, just carryout only, curbside delivery. So that's why we thought transitioning Grove, we're paying rent, we're doing all this stuff. Let's just get this thing up and running and just see if this concept works.
What's on your mind as you think about what business will look like once physical locations, brick and mortar restaurants, are able to reopen?
Well, what we're going to do, I'm just meeting with my senior leadership team. We're going to release our own phase of opening. So it'll be based on what we experience through this, what we're comfortable with. We always kind of want to be pushing the envelope, but we don't want to race to be the first restaurant open. We want to do it based on our values as an organization. And a lot of that's going to also depend on what's happening in these other states that opened. You know, from Georgia to Texas, there's restaurants that are doing the 25%. So it's going to look different. I mean, we're calling it physical distancing in restaurants. I don't want to call social. We want you to be social. You can be with 8-10 people that you know and still have a good time. We're not going to do banquets. There's not going to be rehearsal dinners. There's not going to be events at the Van Andel. So it's just going to be less people. We're just going to be mindful of how we operate in that arena until there's the public is more confident in going out, I guess. I think over time people will do that. Is that a year? Is that 2 years? I don't know, but it's going to be a transition period that, as business is, I mean, we just have to be, you know, willing to try things, but also be mindful of our values and who we are as an organization.
When you think about the kind of restaurant that's going to be able to make the transition into a physically distanced form of business, I mean, does that necessarily have to mean low end? Restaurant business, usually, you know, there's math that has to be done about the number of dinners that you have to sell compared with square footage of your physical location and how much you're paying on the lease every month. That really drives what restaurants can serve and what they can offer.
Well, yeah, the main efficiency that you look in a restaurant, your sales per square foot, that dictates does your concept work. So because that's the same anywhere, whether in New York, whether in Ann Arbor, whether you're in Grand Rapids or Traverse City, because the rent you're paying is pretty consistent with your neighbor. So what you can do per square footage, and that's going to really drive what our menus are going to look like. We can get by for a period of time, but at some point, if they don't get back to what we're normally used to, then something's going to have to change, because we can't all survive on, you know, that model doubling in a negative way, because we just lose the efficiency. And then you're just going to see people are just not going to want to deal with this industry and just pull out of it. So we might have to charge a little bit more on the front end. And the pay model is going to have to be different. You know, part of our big discussion is how we're going to pay our people, because now we're competing with this unemployment thing. So it's just going to, there's a lot of challenges that we have to figure out. And we only get so much grace in the business world. And eventually it's just going to be the ones that figure it out and do it the best long term. You don't have to be first, you have to be best, are the ones that will survive and thrive in the long term.
Would you say that there's anything that's getting you through this right now with so many responsibilities on your shoulders and so many decisions to make about the future?
Well, my team, you know, Hillary Edwards, my partner down here, she's been amazing. Chef Jeremy and Tristan, you know, these guys and Gail's and the team as a whole, you know, I know every day when I wake up, I got a group of people that I'm there for them. They're there for me. And it's a symbiotic relationship we've created these last 8 weeks. And it's the goodwill we've created with each other has been pretty amazing, because we needed each other to do this. And our community has the outreach, the gratitude by them, that as an industry as a whole, that all the restaurants that are out there doing what we're doing, it just, they appreciate it. So I think we're going to get some grace here for the next month or two. And other things getting me by is, like, I'm able to golf, that's a big part of mine. My children, Jake and Molly, spent a lot of time with them, which has been awesome.
Right.
So I look at things, there's good things, bad things. You know, if I have to always decide what's good or bad in my life, I get caught up in those things. So we just look at, you know, this thing has just brought a lot of positives that I never would have thought that I would be seeing now because of this. So, and we see that, you know, there's a silver lining here at the end of this thing.
Could you see yourself taking the dive with a place like Grove again at some point?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, that's if the appetite's there again, then yeah, we will fill the need for sure. Maybe it'll be back at Grove. I don't know, but you know, this at some point will be part of our history. We're just living this part of our history today, and how you live it will matter how you look back on it. That's the message we keep sending to our team.
James Berg is one of the owners of Essence Restaurant Group, best known perhaps for Grove, but now also the proprietor of Jimmy Burger's Chicken Shack. James, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
With hair salons and barbershops still closed, many of us are looking a little more rough around the edges. After the break, we speak with one barber in Ypsilanti about the wait to see when he'll be allowed to get customers back in the chair.
I'm thinking it's going to be a lot more home service taking place as opposed to people going in shops just from fear of sitting in a shop being around, you know, 8, 9, 10 people.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ask your friends what they most wish they had done before the COVID-19 shutdown began. It's likely some of them will mention a haircut. How many times have you glanced in the mirror and thought, just a few more weeks? The less said about DIY personal grooming in these uncertain times, the better. We were curious about how some of the folks doing personal care services in Michigan are making out. So we called up Ryan Griffin. He is a barber and the owner of Griff's Unlimited Cuts in Ypsilanti. He's with us now. Ryan, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Hanging in. So how are things going on for you right now? This is, I want to say, going on week 8, maybe, for the shutdown that has affected people who provide a variety of personal care services.
Yeah, nothing's going on. You know, we can't do anything. So it's really a wait and see game. I'm in a situation to where I'm blessed to where, you know, my wife, you know, she always worked from home. So I'm not in so much of a tight crunch, but it's very difficult because it's times like this where you realize that you were doing a lot more than just giving haircuts. We're an outlet for people. You know, you're losing friends, you're losing camaraderie, just that atmosphere of the barbershop. It's difficult, you know, just not being able to get up in the morning and go through your daily routines, things of that nature. But it is what it is. And hopefully we're going to make the best of it and come out on the other side on top.
For sure. We're seeing businesses that provide different kinds of services try to connect with people in different ways, like chefs going online to share favorite recipes, things like that. But there's just no getting around the fact that if you're cutting someone's hair, you are going to be closer than 6 feet away. There's just not a lot of online options for this. What impact do you think the coronavirus outbreak is going to have on barbershops and salons?
Well, two things. Number one, people are definitely trying to cut their own hair at home. I mean, I get a lot of phone calls, you know, Griff, man, I need to do this, that, and the other. So I walk them through it. And now, you know, us having FaceTime, it's easy to say, listen, just here's a nice, simple way to cut your hair. Don't worry about, you know, the small things like a lineup, you know, but just to where you look decent and your wife won't kick you out the house. You know, I can give those instructions over the phone. But what I've learned, what I've noticed, and what I think is going to happen, I'm thinking it's going to be a lot more home service taking place as opposed to people going in shops just from fear of sitting in a shop being around, you know, 8, 9, 10 people. So I think it's going to be a little different on the other side. You know, people just being a little bit cautious of going right back into a barbershop or a beauty salon or a nail tech. One thing I can say about the barbershop is, and especially, you know, being a Black barber, it's an institution. So I think that the Black barbershop, and I can only speak for that, will rebound fast. Hopefully everyone in whatever barbershop you are, wherever you are, hopefully everyone is safe and hopefully everyone stays healthy. But just knowing the history and the importance of the barbershop, the Black barbershop, and what purpose it serves, I think the barbershops will bounce back really fast.
Under other circumstances, the barbershop might be a place where we'd have a great vantage point for what's going on with the community in Ypsilanti. But from your vantage point and just the people you know, how have you seen the COVID crisis impacting people's lives and families?
I've seen firsthand. I have a very good friend. His name is Alex Fuller. He owns the Fuller Cut Barbershop. He tested positive for COVID. He was sick, hospitalized for a second. Thankfully, he pulled through and he was fine. I have a cousin who went through it, pulled through, was fine. And I'm a big mom and pop guy. I believe in supporting the small local businesses. I don't like the Walmarts. I like supporting the mom and pop stores. And those are the type of businesses that create generational wealth. Those are the type of businesses that you can pass to your children. And when you see people contemplating closing down their business, closing down their shop, it hurts. It really does. It hurts because they didn't do anything to bring this upon themselves, none of our businesses. So to watch people and to talk to people contemplate, I might have to close up. I might have to close up. I mean, it's sad. It hurts. It's very bothersome. But at the same time, I try to communicate with people, make sure that when this is over, we are supporting small local businesses right here in Ypsilanti. We have to support each other for times like this. We have to try to put each other in the black, cash mob type of stuff. Okay, let's pick a restaurant. Let's all just go to that restaurant to make sure that this person is good for, 2 or 3 months.
Right.
So we have to do things like that coming out on the other side.
If your name sounds familiar to folks who are hearing this right now, we might remember that a few years ago you started a Read to Your Barber program. Kids would come in with a book and read to you as you cut their hair, and they would get a little discount off their cut. Have you been able to hear anything from your regular readers?
When all this was kind of happening, and we knew that, and so I did have quite a few people come in and ask for books. Like, Griff, you mind if my kid, we have some of these books, we take some of these books, I promise to bring them back, this, that, and the other. Also do a mentorship program. So it's, again, FaceTime helps a lot at times like this. So some of my younger clients, I still just call, check on them. Honestly, they miss me too. So they'll call
no
it.
No question.
How you doing, Mr. Griff, or whatever? And so, I ask them, what book are you reading? What books have you read? And certain kids that I know that I gave 2 or 3 books, did you finish them yet? Are you doing reports on them or what have you? So I have had the opportunity to talk to a few of the kids in terms of still making sure they're reading, because the kids are still in school. I don't think they'll be done until mid-June.
Right. Unlimited Cuts is a relatively small operation. It's just you and one other barber at the shop. Did you make a run at applying for any of the small business loans that the federal government's made available?
Yeah, I did. And I didn't receive any. What I did, I received the Washtenaw County Resiliency Fund. That was the only one that I received. But at the same time, I didn't go for loans because I didn't want to owe anybody on the other side of it. And again, like I said, I'm in a situation to where I'm not bottomed out yet, so I'm fine. But no, I haven't received any loans. The ones that I applied for, I was denied, or most of them said, we have no more money. 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 So it's like, what can you do about that?
Yeah, they went fast. I don't mean to be flip, but you mentioned that some people have reached out to you for advice about cutting their own hair at home.
Yeah.
What are you telling them?
I tell them how to do it. For example, somebody say, Griff, I need to cut my hair, whatever. I will literally tell them what clippers to use, the guard size to use. I have them cut it and I say, man, call me back, whatever. And they'll do it and they'll call me back. But you have to remember, I've been a barber in this area for almost 20 years. So the relationship that I have with my clients, we have a beautiful relationship. You're talking about the same men that have cried to me. They're telling me their personal problems, their marriage problems, their work problems, or whatever. So it's not a situation where it's like, oh, I'm going to teach you how to cut your hair and I'll no longer be a barber. It's not like that. It's all love. So I'll tell them how to cut their hair and they'll do it.
I know that being at home with family, that's a real blessing for anyone who can do that right now. But perhaps the ones I worry the most about is the folks who are maybe single parents at home with their kids. I mean, putting the clippers in the hands of a 6 or 7-year-old sounds pretty terrifying right now. What's your advice on such a thing?
Well, no, I wouldn't have. No, it wouldn't be a 6 or 7-year-old that do it. It's always the haircut that I can tell them to give. It's called a covadas. It's an old school term, but it's a simple very low haircut, and everybody's fine with it because nobody's going anywhere.
Definitely. What would you say you miss the most about being in the shop right now?
Just being around my clients and talking to my clients and knowing how they depend on me, and not even talking about a haircut, but just the conversations. I have clients that come in for advice. I have clients that come in just to argue with me. I have clients that we talk sports. I have clients that they want to make a career move and we talk about it. There's literally nothing that I haven't talked about, witnessed, or experienced in the barbershop. And every day is different, but every day it's beautiful because it's all learning. And I've learned that over the years. And so I can honestly say I simply miss my clients. I miss everything about my clients, you know. So that is really the hardest part, just dealing with people every day and learning about yourself and learning about others and how to deal with people. And I can honestly say that's what I miss the absolute most, just my clients, period.
Ryan Griffin is the proprietor of Griff's Unlimited Cuts in Ypsilanti. Ryan, good luck. We'll see you on the other side of all this.
Hey, take care. Be safe. God bless and peace be unto you.
Despite the fact that there are no sporting events taking place due to the COVID pandemic, basketball fans have had plenty to talk about with the release of the ESPN documentary, The Last Dance. It follows the career of six-time NBA champion Michael Jordan, covering all the ups and downs of his career, including long battles against the Detroit Pistons and the very contentious relationship between Jordan and the Pistons' Isaiah Thomas. 3 decades later, the bad blood is still obvious. You remember the Pistons walking off the floor during the final seconds of the Bulls' victory over the Bad Boys in the 1991 Eastern Conference Championship? Here's Jordan talking about it.
Well, I know it's all bull. Whatever he says now, you know it wasn't his true actions then. You know, it's time enough to think about it. Or the reaction of the public that's kind of changed his perspective of it. You can show me anything you want. There's no way you can convince me he wasn't that asshole.
And the beefs are flying fast and furious. Let's listen to a bit of Isaiah Thomas's response. He spoke recently with the ESPN show Get Up.
And I remember when we played Boston, and, you know, when Boston exited the floor, you know, for us, it was okay when Boston exited. It was okay when Larry Bird exited. We never looked back and said, oh, they were poor sports. They were bad champions.
Joining us for some armchair history and perspective is Detroit news writer Matt Schock. He's also host of the Pistons podcast, Locked on Pistons. Matt, welcome back to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me, April. Appreciate it.
Hey, Matt, strictly on a fan level, what do you think of Last Dance overall?
Oh, it's been great. And for sports fans who have nothing else much to do these days, Sunday night has been appointment television, and I've enjoyed it. This is like my formative years coming up watching Jordan in the NBA and, of course, the Bad Boys maybe before that in some levels. So, yeah, it's been outstanding.
It's so crazy. I mean, having lived post-LeBron all this time, to remember just what those Jordan years meant at the time, I don't think anybody thought we'd ever get that far away from him.
Yeah, and I think for people in their 20s, younger folks who weren't there for the Jordan era, they're maybe getting a new appreciation for him, especially compared to LeBron, like you said.
Unlike many rivalries, this business between the Pistons and the Bulls during the late 80s and the early 90s just has not seemed to die down. What do you think it is that keeps it going?
It's Michael Jordan, which keeps it going, because he does everything he can to keep this chip on his shoulder, even still 30 years after these things happen. And the people who have slighted Michael Jordan need to get vanquished by him in the media all these years later. And that's kind of what has fueled him. It's kind of a portrait of a psychopath in some ways. I mean, not to the extreme of some of the other documentaries we see out there during the pandemic. But Michael Jordan is as a unique figure in American culture for all the positive things he was celebrated for, and also some of the negative things that come along with his journey to the plateau that he got to. And unfortunately for the memory of the Pistons and the memory of the Bad Boys, to kind of denigrate that in some ways helps lift the icon of Jordan. And that's kind of what we're seeing these days.
Matt, what did you think of what Isaiah Thomas just put forward there right now? Walking off the floor before a game's conclusion. Was that at all very common in the NBA at the time?
the Celtics example, that was a very specific game where the Pistons had beaten Boston in the Eastern Conference Finals at the Silver Dome. So a difference being that when the Celtics, quote unquote, walked off, that was on the road, as opposed to when the Pistons walked off in 91 at the Palace of Auburn Hills. And Boston fans and the Celtics back then maybe would also tell you that it was kind of a safety situation, that the Silver Dome had a little bit lax security. So the players who were on the bench walked off in some reasons because of safety concerns. Now, I haven't heard Larry Bird weigh in these last couple of weeks, but it's just kind of strange that we're having these conversations 30 years later, that Isaiah Thomas didn't and Bill Laimbeer and Mark Aguirre didn't shake those hands at the end of the series, which, you know, sportsmanship's important. We should teach our kids to be good sports. But in the context of historical NBA arguments, I just don't see why it's that important that we're having these kind of who did what and when discussions, given that we're having these macro conversations about legacy and who was better and all those kind of things.
You know, the dislike, I suppose I'm using the mild phrase, between Jordan and Thomas is just so upfront in this. Was there more to the rivalry than this personal thing between Michael Jordan and Isaiah Thomas?
Yeah, and it was just it was because that Jordan had to get through the Pistons so the Bulls could get to the top of the NBA. But I think, well, as you watch this Jordan documentary, and I'm speaking here from a Pistons perspective, someone who's been studying this team really my whole life, something that's kind of getting lost, particularly in this documentary, is that Isaiah Thomas is from the near west side of Chicago. So Isaiah Thomas was watching Michael Jordan live the life that he probably hoped that he would have. And of course, nobody feels bad for Isaiah Thomas. He had a great career and is mentioned as one of the top 15, 20 basketball players of all time, even today. But you have to keep in mind that while as great as Isaiah was accomplishing all these things, he wasn't living the life that Michael Jordan was living. You know, Isaiah grew up what is now about walking distance from the United Center. Now, the United Center was not built when he was growing up. They put it at the old Chicago Stadium. But just it's something to keep in mind that Michael Jordan, you know, grew up in North Carolina, came to Isaiah Thomas's city and became kind of the player that Isaiah probably wished that he would become.
Over the years, there have been unconfirmed reports that Jordan made sure to keep Isaiah Thomas off the 1992 U.S. Olympic men's basketball team, the dream team that everybody remembers so well. Isaiah was on the team in 1980, but he didn't compete because of a U.S. boycott. I mean, has any additional information come out in the ensuing years about those allegations?
Yeah, that's been kind of one of the hot topics of this week. And again, this is something that we're almost 30 years past at this point. But, you know, there was a Michael Wilbon, the ESPN reporter, said that he had talked to as many as 9 members of the Dream Team that corroborated they didn't want Isaiah on the team. But then when some evidence was presented to him after it aired this week, he recanted those statements and said that that was not true. Michael Jordan in the documentary said that there was never a hard and fast thing that he said, that he laid down the gauntlet and said that Isaiah can't be on the team. They referenced his rivalries with Larry Bird and Magic Johnson at the time. So it's this gray area that we're all kind of trying to figure out 30 years ago. But it was, you know, kind of sad to see Isaiah and how stricken he was by that. You can imagine that this is a historic team that they put together, and he obviously deserved to be on it and wasn't put on. So it was, there was kind of a touching moment to see him kind of upset about that even decades later.
You know, since The Last Dance came out on stream, we've seen some articles detailing actions Isaiah Thomas has taken since retiring as a player. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, there is a lot of good stuff out there. And the thing about Isaiah, the thing that jumps out is his reputation is not great nationally in terms of his post-basketball career. He had failures as the commissioner of the CBA. He had a bad run as the president of the Toronto Raptors when they started their team, and then had an unsuccessful run as a front office with the New York Knicks as well, which also had some sexual harassment allegations involved too. But there's also a lot of good that he's done in terms of social justice movements, the LGBTQ movement as well. He's done a lot of great things out there, and some of those things are getting detailed. And it's interesting to see, you know, Pistons fans kind of rally around their guy. Keep in mind, this is the greatest Piston of all time. So fans are kind of rallying around Zeke. And the Jordan folks are kind of on the other side as well. So it's interesting watching everyone litigate this stuff decades later and kind of rushing to their corners to defend their guys.
Matt Schock of the Detroit News. You can also read him at playmichigan.com or hear him on the daily Locked on Pistons podcast. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. This has been fun watching. I'm almost ready for another helping already.
Yeah, two more episodes. We'll see how it goes. Thanks, April. Appreciate it.
And that's Stateside for this week. Producers of the show are Laura Weber-Davis, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Mike Blank, with help from our fabulous interns, Leah Baldori, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you next week.